This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. Wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. And this is a trial of the week, where I review a landmark article in critical care and emergency medicine that was published this month in Medical History. And today we're going to have a little fun, because not only are we going to talk about research from the 1980s that is still applicable today, but we're also covering two trials. So Salia Farouk, neurocritical care pharmacist extraordinaire, returns to discuss two of the landmark nimodipine research articles, the 1983 New England Journal of Medicine and 1989 British Medical Journal research studies looking at the use of nimodipine in aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. So we set the scene describing what treatments we had in the 1970s and 1980s, going into things like pathophysiology and appropriate terminology. Then we dive into the two studies. We highlight humorous differences in research at that time, but of course we talk about the findings, implications, and considerations from these studies. And then where are we now, going into how we still use nimodipine today and what research has been published since that's influenced our use of nimodipine. Now, of note, you'll probably hear and see that these trials were released in March. And of course, you're listening to this and it is early April. I screwed up, friends. Just made a wrong notation on the calendar. So there's a funny note of it on the social media graphics. Hopefully no one's losing any sleep a few days late, but still very, very great. Now, this is also the last episode that'll get released before the national champion is crowned in the 2024 Critical Care Trials March Madness bracket. So SOAP 2, ARDSnet, Nice Sugar, and NINS battling for that number one spot at Pharmacy to Dose on social media to vote. So a great episode with an even better guest. So let's get going.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
So we are very lucky to welcome back Salia Farouk to highlight our March trial of the week. I guess you'd say trials of the week, looking at two landmark nimodipine articles. Now, Salia is a neurocritical care clinical pharmacy specialist at Johns Hopkins Hospital. You can find her on Twitter or X at Salia_Farouk, her name, which is always cool in this day and age when you get your full name. So Salia, welcome back. How are you doing?
Hi, Nick. Thank you so much. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Happy March Madness season. Happy surviving residency recruitment season. It's just a great time all around. Definitely trying to get through what's certainly a busy phase in the calendar. Isn't it crazy?
It's been busy. You said it.
Now let's kind of set the scene here. We're going to do something a little different because we're going to try to talk about more than one study, but obviously kind of linked in themselves. But let's set the scene in when, you know, these studies are talking about adverse effects secondary to aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. And specifically, they talk about delayed cerebral ischemia and cerebral artery vasospasm. So what is, describe to us what's happening physiologically and why this is so crucial to prevent these adverse effects.
Sure. So I think one maybe disclaimer is that there was a time in medicine that we called these complications vasospasm. I think it's probably fair to say that at this point, we don't really think that vasospasm is the right term. And I think that's when we get to, you know, old trials and new trials. The idea really here is that in the setting of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, the blood can be very, very inflammatory and toxic to the point that the arteries around it can have some narrowing, and the narrowing can basically compromise the blood flow, and that can technically lead to infarcts. Hence the name delayed cerebral ischemia. Now you may ask, why delayed? Unlike a lot of, you know, medical emergencies, this medical emergency or neuro emergency, I should say, doesn't happen immediately. Usually we think that this happens starting day 4-ish. The peak is around day 7 to 10, and it can really last up to 21 days, although there are some reports that this can go on until day 40. So this is really a kind of continuous and progressive infarct that can happen for these patients, and it can be very, very significant with a lot of morbidity and mortality, and hence why we're talking about it today.
Now, when we go through the years, right, this is an old trial. So what types of treatments were we doing in the late 70s and early 80s in these patients?
I really think that before then, there was not a whole lot of pharmacologic. You know, there was this whole discussion about Triple H, which is, you know, hypertension, hemodilution, and hypervolemia, which they were doing. They were thinking maybe magnesium, maybe other agents, but really nimodipine didn't show up in the literature until 1981, 1982, and then the 1983 trial that we're going to talk about. But, and then obviously surgical interventions. The 80s really when we start to see a lot of these, you know, medical interventions, or I should say farm interventions. And before that, it was probably all surgical or the Triple H that we talked about.
So, you know, there's one of the bigger studies before this 1983 is the 1981 study you referenced. So what type of evidence did we have for nimodipine prior to this 1983 New England Journal of Medicine study?
I think before that, just like you said, a few years before 1981, there was a study that, you know, if you did nimodipine as this very unique and lipophilic calcium channel blocker, you're going to have reduction of narrowing of the vessels and maybe better blood flow, and that could possibly help these patients. And I think that started this whole kind of surge of trials about how can we use nimodipine in these patients? What's the right dose? What's the right frequency? For how long should we keep that? And all of that. And then, you know, we'll get into different trials and different studies and different kind of regimens. But you're right. I think 1981 is probably the initiation of all of this.
So let's kind of get into our first trial of the week, the 1983 cerebral arterial spasm, a controlled trial of nimodipine in patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage. So multicenter, prospective, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled, all the things we like. Patients between the ages of 15 and 80 within 96 hours of the radiographically confirmed aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage diagnosis with, quote-unquote, this is from the article, normal results on a neurologic exam, except, and then it lists like a paragraph of things that are not normal, but things like stiff neck, fever, photophobia, things that are going to be less maybe affecting your like GCS, for example. So patients were randomized to nimodipine or placebo. Little unique dosing regimen, got a 0.7 mg per kg oral loading dose, and then 0.35 mg per kg every 4 hours, total of 21 days. The co-primary outcome was the development of a neurologic deficit secondary to that cerebral arterial spasm, and then secondary to that kind of the severity of the deficit that came. So 121 patients enrolled and randomized with similar baseline characteristics. You know, it's funny when you read older studies because the text almost suggests that the authors were surprised. Remarkably similar with respect to several factors, like it was one of those where they expected big differences, but they weren't. So, hey, pleasant surprise, but just kind of wanted to highlight some of the funny differences from our earlier medical writing. So I'll come back in. What did they find? And maybe highlight or reiterate anything from the methods you think is important.
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise to me, Nick, was that what they, and again, this is 1983, right? About 30 years ago, 40 years ago, really, I should say, the way they classified subarachnoid hemorrhage is very different from what we're classifying these patients now. So I had to go back and look and see what they were talking about. Their kind of description of these patients and their baseline characteristic is very, very descriptive. Meaning, you know, they kind of just like you said, they have a table and they literally are explaining these patients' neuro exam, which I was really shocked by that. I think on a fun note, they really literally say they took these scans to Dr. Fisher and so, and they asked them to look at it and kind of provide feedback. And this kind of comes into play that, you know, initially it was the Fisher's criteria for these patients, looking at the degree of blood, the thickness of the blood, and then correlating that with the amount of vasospasm. And guess what? Now we're using the modified Fisher, which is kind of changing that approach a little bit. And talking about, you know, patients with, again, the degree of the blood in their head and the risk of vasospasm. So I thought that was one of the biggest differences that, you know, if you are undergoing neurocritical care training these years or these days, I should say, you look back at this and you're trying to really put it together, you're a little bit lost because you don't really know what degree of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage they had. And then, you know, they, just like we're going to talk about more and more, they really focused on the degree of vasospasm. And what they found was that the patients who received nimodipine had better outcomes as far as vasospasm. And then they also commented on the fact that their neurologic exam was also better after receiving nimodipine. And that persisted despite, you know, looking at other factors, which was interesting and kind of the biggest report that they had. So I think these were the major points. Again, I'm still kind of shocked by looking at the table and seeing that they're really describing every little neuro deficit that these patients had, which really makes it hard for a reader to look at it and, you know, really get a good understanding of these patients' outcomes. It's not like, you know, they have scores to report. It's not that they could make it very objective. So that's just something to think about. And I thought it was a fun fact to talk about that.
Yeah. So for the listeners, you should definitely try to pull this study and look, but like the example that I want to use is, it says patient one disoriented to city, right? That's how like patient level we got in the discussion. So I also thought that was something humorous that I wanted to highlight. Now, the other thing, I think even if you may not be a neurocritical care pharmacist, most of us are somewhat familiar with that classic nimodipine dosing regimen. It's not this, right? So how did they come up with this? Is there some story as to how they came up with this regimen? Or is it one of those where, you know what, we wanted to be sure we didn't underdose, and so that's why we chose it?
Yeah, that's a fun fact also. So you're right. If you ask anyone, and, you know, who has ever done any sort of critical care, they would say that, you know, yes, nimodipine dosing is very standard. We do 60 milligrams Q4. And then it's also, I think, not uncommon to hear that if someone's hypotensive, you break it down and you do 30 milligrams Q2. And I think, you know, they've kind of been doing that for some time. As you said, they didn't do our typical dosing of 60 milligrams Q4. They had their whole system of doing 0.7 milligrams per kg oral, kind of as a loading dose, followed by 0.35 milligrams every 4 hours, again, oral. They did talk about how they got there. It's interesting. They kind of referenced some PK studies and how, you know, they knew how much they needed for getting to 50% basically blocking of calcium channels. Not to go into a lot of details, but one thing, fun fact about nimodipine is that it's the most lipophilic calcium channel blocker. There's also this really cool hypothesis that nimodipine may be doing more of blocking the extracellular calcium as opposed to intracellular calcium. And people think that in the cerebral arteries, the external calcium is what may be toxic, not the internal calcium. So that might be something unique about this whole process. But what they were saying is that with the concentration of the dosing that they proposed, they were sure that they were going to be within that range, that it was going to be blocking at least 50% of the calcium channels in the brain. Now, they also actually, if you think about it, though, when you do some sort of math, right, for, let's say, a normal 70 kilogram person, the dose ends up to be lower than what we typically do. It's going to be around 30, 40 milligrams Q4. They said that because they were not sure about the dosing and the adverse events. They did a little bit lower. And so that's something to kind of note. And also they said that they didn't report a lot of hypotension. In my head, I'm like, well, of course you didn't, because your dosing is a little bit lower than usual. In practice, we do see hypotension. It's not uncommon, actually, for these people to be hypotensive on nimodipine, and we break down the dose, or sometimes we have to think about other interventions and such. But that's, in a nutshell, how they got to the dose, and, you know, how they ended up doing a little bit lower, I think, because they were worried about the side effects and they wanted to make sure they were a little bit more conservative than being more aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, they were doing spinal taps. They're getting CSF concentrations in these research patients. So they were doing it all. It's very interesting to read the hypotheses of how they thought it worked and some of the things in this study, because you can obviously see in some of the methods and things they did what they were hypothesizing.
Yeah, it's again shocking. I can tell you that we don't do CSF analysis of these patients. We don't measure nimodipine serum or a CSF concentration. I think it was nice. They kind of proved the fact that, oh, like, you know, we know nimodipine is 90% protein bound. And guess what? Only 10% was found in a CSF. Oh, guess what? Like, we like kind of confirmed that it's 90% protein bound. I do think, though, it's nice that they have this report of the CSF concentration to say that it's penetrating the brain. And I think given that the oral, you know, absorption could be very variable depending on the mode of administration, depending on the food kind of, you know, intake and all of that, I think it's nice that they reported something, but I don't know that that level is really clinically meaningful to us, because we don't really use it for any dose titration. So I think it's just good academic exercise, but it's not really helpful for clinical adjustments of any interventions in neurocritical care at this point for these patients.
Why did they want treatment to start within 96 hours? Does it have something to do with that delayed process you were talking about?
Exactly. I think this is pretty common in a lot of the studies that, you know, we do want to start within 4 days or 96 hours, because we really want to make sure that we start before the peak. And this also highlights the fact that you really want to do nimodipine as a prophylactic measure. The idea is that, you know, if the damage is already done, it's probably unlikely that nimodipine can fix it. It may help, you know, minimize or prevent the next damage from happening. Remember that we said that this is a very progressive kind of disease. But if the damage is already done, you can't really fix that. So I think the idea is that you definitely want to do it within 96 hours. And ironically, actually, the new 2023 guidelines say as early as possible. So they don't even put a timestamp on it. You know, as soon as you can, as soon as you get these patients and you have enteral access, go ahead and start it.
So the kind of in-between scenes, right? So in between our two studies, right, you know, there was another landmark study 6 years later. So if we were a skeptic and we didn't necessarily, we're like, wait a minute, I don't know if I believe this. What do you think that some of the skeptics at the time might be saying in terms of why they needed to justify this other study? Even having, you know, cause talking about a couple of studies that had positive results up to this point.
Yeah, I think the biggest part or piece about aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage is that there is so much going on in these patients. You know, it's not really just the vasospasm. There is electrolyte abnormality, especially hyponatremia. There is hydrocephalus that could be happening. You know, people could have blood pressure variations. That is the worst thing that can happen to these patients, with the fluctuations and the oxygenation to the brain. So I think I think the biggest critique to the study was that you made this disease very simple. This is not just a one problem, syndrome. This is not let's fix the vasospasm and then fix the disease. There's so much to think about. And, not all vasospasm were detected with TCDs and things like that. So this whole kind of claim that if, you fix this and then you're going to see it on a TCD or a transcranial Doppler, I should say, you are going to get the best neurologic or functional outcome is something to think about. The other piece of, I think, this trial that I thought was helpful to think about, and the new trial that we're going to talk about really caught that, is that looking at these outcomes on day 21, maybe too early, this is actually a common theme in neurocritical care. We've learned this in ICH too, right? If you're withdrawing care on day 30 and you're not giving your patient more time, you may be actually misjudging the whole prognosis. And that's why this is really important. I think, this trial that we just talked about, they kind of look at everything on day 21. And the new trials are now looking at maybe we should extend that. Maybe the right amount of time is 3 months. Maybe we should give it more time. And I think that's another piece of information that was missing in this trial that could be looked at if they were going to look at a more global approach.
I'm not going to lie, I was kind of bummed. I thought it was going to be a European versus American kind of thing, because one of these is a North American study. The one we'll talk about is European. Your explanation, of course, makes more sense. This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. So 1983 to 1989, was there any other kind of higher quality nimodipine research that came out that, showed any type of differences, whether it was positive or negative, or were we kind of all waiting up until this next study?
I think if you think about it, this is really 3 years after, right? So this was 1983 and then, 6 years, 1989. So I think there was one study that was published in 1986 that showed almost the same thing as the 1983 trial, if I'm not mistaken, but 6 years is not a long time. I'm actually surprised that this even happened. But I think we could say that given that both got published in New England, these are probably the major landmark trials, but there was one study in 1986. And I think looking back, there's another study in 1987, but really showing similar effects. I think the vasospasm was probably what they all focused on and looking at, the vasodilatory effects of calcium channel blockers. But really this trial, the 1989 by Pickard, is the one that, just like you were saying, the one that was British, kind of helped identify some other risk factors. What else is happening? What other factors should we think about? But if we were just talking about this, the Pickard trial is probably the one that I would assign all my residents and all my students to read about. I think this trial really kind of puts it into perspective and talks about maybe we shouldn't say vasospasm, we should say DCI or delayed cerebral ischemia. But excited to talk about it more.
Yeah, the 1989 British Medical Journal article, also published in March, so March in the 80s, big month for nimodipine, entitled "The Effect of Oral Nimodipine on Cerebral Infarction and Outcome After Subarachnoid Hemorrhage, the British Aneurysm Nimodipine Trial." Now, first things first, you could tell that acronyms were not a big thing back then, because BANT is not an awesome acronym for this study. This, like, practice-changing study. So that is, you could tell the difference in the 80s versus now and the influence of our acronyms. But it's an English multi-center prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And so, kind of like you said, it enrolled patients from June of 85 to September 87. So it really feels like they saw the results in March and they hit their IRB running to get this thing going and started working on it. Because that is, you're absolutely right, in a research world, that is a very, very quick turnaround for this high-quality prospective RCT.
So, yeah, 100%. 100%.
The primary outcome, 90-day incidence of cerebral infarct and ischemic neurologic deficits. One of the biggest differences, right, is just the sheer number of patients. So they calculated a pre-specified sample size of 540 patients to detect a 50% in cerebral infarct incidence. And 554 patients with similar baseline characteristics were enrolled and randomized. And they randomized either placebo or the nimodipine dosing regimen that we know and love, the 60 milligrams orally every 4 hours for 21 days. So, Sahlia, what did they ultimately find in this British trial? And maybe what are some highlights from the methodology perspective?
You said, Nick, I think this was just, this feels more like a more recent trial than the other trial. This is done more like, you know, the statistics and everything about a trial is, feels very recent. I think the biggest piece of this trial is that they do have the GCS as their classification. And that's also very helpful because I can read this trial and kind of relate to this trial and think about my patients and who would qualify in this study. So that was really helpful. And then what they, it was only in, you know, England. So you could think about how, you know, practices are different. And that's actually really important because, right, like even in the US, you go to one center, depending on their, the volume of SAH patients that they get, the practice could be very different. That's why actually the guidelines say, when you get these patients, the first thing you should do is that transfer them to the high volume centers because you do want all the capabilities. My assumption is that just reading about a trial, all four centers we're talking about in England had high volume SAE patients. So they were very skilled to take care of these patients. The biggest piece of this information is that they really, really ignored vasospasm. And they really focused on their first outcome to look at was infarction. And the second outcome to look at was the incidence of poor outcomes, poor functional outcomes. So this is, I think, is huge. They talk about what they found, obviously, and they explain their findings, which is also exciting in how they go about that. But I think those are probably the major differences. But I think, again, this definitely feels more like standard of care, especially with the statistics, the methods, the classification of patients, and also admitting that this disease has a lot of complications, just like what we talk about, hydrocephalus, hyponatremia, all the things that you need to think about as opposed to just focusing on basically angiogram-related narrowing of the vessels.
Is that the biggest difference from these two trials, kind of that angiographic point of view, or are there other bigger differences, not necessarily from the like the kind of old versus new, but just from like a patient's and kind of compare and contrast between them?
I think one more difference, the biggest difference is that the nimodipine dosing, which, you know, we didn't really like as part of their methods, they do use the typical dose of 60 milligrams Q4. As far as the patient description, they had more patients. Again, it's hard to really compare patients side by side because of different kind of, you know, capturing of these patients. But it's fair to say that at least from looking at these two trials, both populations, placebo versus nimodipine, in both groups were pretty comparable, which I think is the biggest piece here. And this trial also showed that despite kind of correcting for all the other factors, treatment effects seemed to be persistent and seemed to be statistically significant, which was helpful to see. But I think my point of view is that I think really the outcomes that they looked at and how they were able to actually recruit for the right number of patients to show that it was statistically significant and not to only mention that it was also clinically meaningful. In addition, that they also looked at, you know, really looked at infarct as their primary outcome seemed to be the biggest difference and not really just focusing on the vasospasm.
So was the controversy over at this point? Was everybody team nimodipine after this came out?
So, you know, nimodipine in this trial showed that these patients, and again, not only just to add to that, not only they look at 21 day outcome, they look at 3 months, which is huge. You know, it's very, again, that's why I feel so much more recent medicine than, you know, the other one, which was only 6 years away or apart. And they actually did not find any changes in vasospasm. And that's why I think the whole kind of terminology about nitazoxanone fixing vasospasm got changed. So people, please don't say vasospasm, say DCI. You know, nitazoxanone does not change the vasospasm. Nitazoxanone helps with delayed cerebral ischemia. And I think this is really a trial that made it clear that this is a terminology. This is how we should talk about nitazoxanone. So this was a positive trial. Obviously, this worked for nimodipine. There was not a statistical difference between mortality between the two groups for the effect size that they had set up. But the overall functional outcomes and actually infarct size, they were better with the nimodipine group. But do I think that this is the end of it for us? Do I think that everyone should get nimodipine? So there is a few things that I want to highlight. If you ask me, I think the debate is still probably out there. A few things about why I think so. Number one, I think, is that some people say that when you actually, you know, talk about this at different journal clubs, even this 1989 study, some people claim that people who received nimodipine, because there was this conversation or this hesitation that they may drop their blood pressure, they were getting more fluids right off the bat. And so maybe these people had a better volume status. And because we know that euvolemia is great for these people, and any degree of hypovolemia could be associated with worse outcomes, maybe these patients did better, not because of just nimodipine. And to piggyback to that, you know, in a lot of these trials, we're not really looking at other medications that they're getting, other, you know, drug-drug interactions. We all know that nimodipine goes through a lot of CYP3A4. So, you know, what if some of these patients that, you know, were getting nimodipine, were getting other drugs that could have changed, you know, the concentration, that may have led to maybe more concentration of the drug, and that's why these people did better on this dose, but they wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't have done this great if it was, you know, with another DDI that reduced the concentration of nimodipine. And then, you know, they're not really reporting sodium levels, which I really was hoping to see, because that's so huge for these patients to see how many of these patients are within the range, how many of these patients are not within the range. And then, you know, we had a nice publication in 2022 that talked about, in pharmacotherapy, that talked about different methods of administration can lead to different outcomes. So were these people getting, you know, with the enteral nimodipine, were they getting the solution, or were they getting, you know, the capsules that nurses had to open up and kind of like, you know, get the gel out with a syringe and give it, which we all know has had so many kind of adverse events and issues, even mortality when they were injected, which was not intended to be injected. But there's a lot of, I think, variables that should be taken into account. And more recently, actually, this has been a focus of research in neurocritical care, that people are really looking at oxygenation at tissue level with nimodipine administration, because all these, you know, ups and downs in the blood pressure variability obviously is going to compromise the blood flow to the brain and oxygenation. It'll be really nice to see if, you know, the variability in blood pressure that is caused by nimodipine could lead to some of these really big events. And maybe you do need to actually have some sort of consistent formulation of nimodipine, such as IV nimodipine, that is very constant so that you don't have those variability. So I don't know that I can say we have the answer. I think we probably, nimodipine is probably beneficial to some point. I don't know that we have a great explanation for it. I don't know that we have really looked at all the variables in the studies that are published already. And I think, you know, again, like with the absorption problems with nimodipine, it really highlights that this is a major problem. And maybe all the studies that looked at this, you know, they really were not looking into that, which could be different for every patient, even, you know, within this the same study. So there's a lot of variables. I think the future will tell us more. So I think that the debate will still be, you know, out there.
So the other thing that stood out from this, the text, is it discusses compliance. And what they said was they deemed that a patient who missed more than two doses was non-compliant. So in real life, when we're thinking about these patients, right, every 4 hours, right, like things can happen. So what happens in real life if you miss multiple doses? Do we know how that affects patients? And then the other thing is, does the countdown start over at any point, or how does that work with the timing?
That's a great question, Nick. So I think the beauty of being in the ICU, at least, is that, and you know, you're right, sometimes these people look actually really amazing. They don't look that sick, but we know that these patients can get very sick very quickly, and it's delayed, right? Just because they're not sick on day five doesn't mean that they're not going to be sick on day 10. So at least I know that a lot of ICUs, neurocritical care units, they keep these patients. So I think for the time of them being in the ICU, it's pretty consistent administration. You have a good point about missing doses. What if someone missed doses for whatever reason, one or two doses for the setting of, let's say, hypertension or other things that could happen even in the intensive care unit? So we typically, if it's because people didn't tolerate it, and that's why it had to be on hold, as an institution, we don't restart account. We don't say, oh, like this patient, you know, missed, I don't know, four doses. We have to add four extra doses to the full duration of treatment. I do have to say, though, if someone's on nimodipine and they had a new DCI that is concerning, or if they have a rebleed that is concerning, we do start the whole count. And that is not really published. This is something that I think we've talked with different, you know, this is something we talk about like at different, you know, critical care communities and conferences, and we ask for experts' opinion, and you know, people have done this for years, and I think this is something that we've all kind of agreed to do for the most part, that because this is such a progressive disease, that if you have a new kind of infarct or a new rebleed episode, it's probably safe to restart. Obviously, if the you have to make sure the patient can tolerate it. If the patient cannot tolerate it, it's a separate issue. And then you kind of have to talk about what comes first, because you obviously don't want to compromise cerebral perfusion. But I think we don't typically recount if one or two or three doses are, let's say, obviously if it's like days of therapy that are missed, that's a different situation. But if it's a few doses and the patient's doing well, and it was because of, I don't know, transfer to the neuro IR or some other issues and they came back, or other reasons, we don't restart. But if it's for neurologic kind of deterioration and a new DCI, we do start the whole count again, which, you know, is kind of excessive, I think, right? We're like starting like another 21 days, but that's what we've been doing. And again, like I'm sure other folks may have other experiences, which would be nice to hear.
Well, and you get into the point where like we're probably not going to have like a randomized double blind 300 patient trial looking at that exact scenario, right? And you start having to get more into like the case series, case reports, that sort of thing. And that's where the collaboration, that's kind of, you're doing the best you can, right? And that's what everyone's doing in these patients. That's why, you know, when you think about their score prediction, their Hunt-Ness score, the worse they do, their mortality skyrockets. And so the idea of trying to prevent that, to prevent getting in those last line scenarios, is something important.
Exactly.
So is there any other research on the horizon? Or, you know, you mentioned the Sharif Mahmood and your research publications looking at the different formulations. I also thought it was interesting that first study had tablets. And how much would life be easier if we had nimodipine tablets? So I thought that was funny that that's what they used. But have there been any either recent studies or things that you hear through the grapevine that are going to be released in the next couple months?
Yeah, I think just like you said, Mahmoud's study was, I thought, very eye-opening for especially the pharmacists out there. So if people have not looked at that, please do. It really is eye-opening that just emphasizing the variability in pharmacokinetics of nimodipine based on different formulations and how it was actually given. And outcomes, you know, when we talk about formulations, we don't really talk about outcomes as much. You know, we talk about operations and costs and things like that. But the fact that they looked at outcomes and DCI, I thought that was very smart and fascinating. I think another study that was recent in 2024, it was a German study that they looked at people who actually had reduced daily doses of nimodipine. And we're not talking about 30 Q2, we're talking about actually like missing doses and not getting to full treatment and how those patients did worse. And those patients were on either oral or IV, and some people actually received both because it was in Europe, and apparently Europe has the IV formulation, we don't. So that was just interesting because, you know, sometimes when you miss doses, you think about the IV formulation. And again, like you can think about also reasons for not getting the IV also. So it really highlights the fact that you really need to, if you want to see a full benefit, you have to keep it consistent, which, you know, brings up this whole another debate about do you start your norepinephrine when someone's on nimodipine or not? And I have, if I'm going to go on the record and say this, I probably belong to that group that felt like, what are you doing if you're a norepinephrine and nimodipine? But the more I read about it, the more I think that I do have maybe a low threshold to start norepinephrine while my patient's on nimodipine, unless my doses of norepinephrine are getting so high that there is no point for them to be on a vasodilator. So again, I think this is something that everyone should decide for themselves based on what they read. But I think that there may be a utility to keep your norepinephrine nimodipine unless your norepinephrine doses are going so high that you just know that you can't keep up with that. And you know, it's going to have some cardiac complications, which actually these patients are at high risk of. Initially, it's not uncommon for these people to have cardiac complications, the surge of this norepinephrine release. So I thought that was interesting. And then what is, I think, also one area of research in neurocritical care is that a lot of people are looking at tissue oxygenation of the brain with doses of nimodipine, because the idea is that it's not that just the, you know, hypotension is bad, is that, you know, if you're trying to improve or prevent infarcts from happening, but you're compromising the blood flow to the brain so much because they're so hypotensive, what are we doing at that point? But no one really knows the exact, you know, impact of this on the brain tissues. But recently, actually, at SCCM, there was a platform presentation about it. So I think this is up and coming that people are going to talk about tissue oxygenation of the brain and the impact of nimodipine. So more to come on that, I think. I think we may learn more about the brain and the oxygenation based on nimodipine or other medications that could be fluctuating the blood pressure. And that might be really interesting to see and kind of, you know, take that into account also as an important factor.
And listeners, if any of that stuff sounded appealing, especially, you know, we were talking about Sharif Mahmood studies and things. We were lucky enough to have Casey May come on and talk about aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, just talking about some of these exact things. So you'll be proud to know that Casey's shares your side with a few things. We will I'll leave the listeners to listen, but it's certainly a great minds think alike scenario there. But this was fun. So I always enjoy highlighting studies that are so old, the guidelines have to say it is important to acknowledge the age of the data guiding its use and limitations of these RCTs. So, what a fun trip back in memory lane, but also talking about how those evidence have kind of impacted our care today with this infamous neurocritical care drug. So, at Salya Farouk for everybody, and Salya, we greatly appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Have a good day, everyone. And you too, Nick.
Thanks again to Salya. So great. Learn something new every time we get the chance to hear her speak. And remember, let her know how great she did at Salya_Farouk. Reach out to me. Let me know your thoughts, ideas, suggestions at Pharmacy to Dose. The reference list with links to some of these ancient studies will be in the episode description, as well as that website, pharmacytodose.com. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, And this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only, does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials on the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guest and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACCP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.